Welcome to The Womb Radio. I'm Paul Kavicki, your host, also known as Pounce, the moderator of the live forum. I'm here with Richard Shack. Most recently, I saw him with the band The Muzzle Loaders, so named because they're a bunch of old guns. They pack the Rivari Room on North High Street here in Columbus, Ohio. But you may know him better from his work as the guitarist from the James Gang. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Paul.
You are perhaps most famous for the work with the James Gang, because you hit with some rock and roll all-stars in the heyday of rock and roll. When were you running around with them?
I was in the James Gang in 1974, 1975.
So that's a good time for rock and roll.
Yes, that was a time when a lot of stuff was happening and a lot of great writing going on, a lot of great bands going on. For instance, one of the early gigs we played was in Sheep's Meadow, an area of Central Park. It was going to be a live gig. Lots of people out there. A guy named Peter Frampton. We opened up for Peter Frampton, and it turned out that was Peter Frampton's. That was at least part of Peter Frampton Comes Alive.
At the time, the greatest selling live recording.
Exactly. Number one live recording ever. I'm sure it's been eclipsed by somebody. But back then, that was it. And as a matter of fact, I remember there were so many people out there, they couldn't put the spotlights out in the house, so to speak, or out on the... So they actually had mirrors on an angle in front of us downstage and had the lights go from behind us to hit the mirror and then back down on us. I don't think I played a gig anywhere else where they did that, but we had no idea. I remember thinking, hey, Frampton sounds pretty good. I had no idea that, you know...
You were kind of at a history-making show.
Yeah, I mean, later we found out, oh my God, this thing is freaking huge, you know? So we were on that. That was kind of cool.
And you would say that sometimes you can get a little bit of a special feeling when things are very especially right at a gig like that?
Absolutely. You sort of know when there's a little bit of magic going on. And even though we were the opening act, we weren't, we weren't the shit, as they say. He was. But yeah, it was kind of nice to be on a gig that, you know, so many people, good vibe and all that stuff. And then, 6 months or a year later, whenever it was that they released that thing, and it was like, oh my God, I was there.
Let me rewind for a second. What was your musical life like leading up until you got there? Were you in a lot of bands, music lessons? What got you to a point where you would eventually be working with Joe Walsh or stuff like that?
Well, I'm from Cleveland originally, where the James Gang was out of, and I played in a band with Jimmy Fox, who was the drummer in the James Gang. We had a band in Columbus, Ohio called the Governors. And that was with a dash, G-U-V-N-O-R-S, because we all wanted to be English at the time. So that would be Govno, that kind of thing. And I stayed in Columbus for a while. Jimmy went back to Cleveland and started the James Gang when they were a local band. Then I moved back to Cleveland from Columbus. And I had a band called the Case of E.T. Hooley. And we were sort of rival bands in Cleveland. And E.T. Hooley moved to L.A. to try to make it, and then the James Gang did make it. And I was in L.A. for 5.5 years. I played in a band called Uncle Tom there that no one heard of, but we did record on United Artists Records. And eventually, the lead singer, Bubba Keith, and myself got called from the James Gang after Tommy Bolin left the James Gang after Joe Walsh had a guy named Don Triano, who was a famous Canadian guitar player, and he was with them for a little while. Then they had Tommy Bolin, who was a known rocker out of Boulder, Colorado, and then he left to go up to Canada to play with the Guess Who, and they called Bubba and I to come from L.A. We moved back to Cleveland. I moved back to Cleveland. Bubba's actually from Dallas, Texas. And in October of 74, we came back to Cleveland, recorded an album, and went on the road with the James Gang. So I knew Jimmy, and I knew Jimmy from high school. So that was how I ended up in the James Gang. And I had been in many other local bands in LA, did this, did that. I was, always a rocker, a blues-oriented rocker.
So even in the story so far, there are at least two different record. How many different record labels did you find yourself associated with?
I was with United Artists in Los Angeles, and then I recorded with the James Gang on Atco, which is, that's Atlantic. Mm. It's just a subsidiary of Atlantic. And that was an exciting time. And, we recorded and went out on tour. I think our first gig was with Marshall Tucker in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And then we just toured. We toured with Alice Cooper. We toured with ZZ Top. We toured with Kiss.
Somehow I think of you as being very much a live guy. I mean, you can really play, and you like to play, and you seem to enjoy the audience feedback. Did you enjoy the studio stuff, or were you more of a studio or a live guy?
I was more of a live guy, especially then when I went to record. I'd done a little bit of recording, but I hadn't really done much recording when I joined the James Gang. I wish I knew then what I know now, but that's, you can say that for almost anything. But yeah, I was a live guy. I love the blues. And as I started to become a songwriter, my songs were, I didn't write blues songs per se, but they were sort of a little bit blues oriented. You know, we were listening to Clapton and Hendrix at the time. They were the big influences back then. Clapton and Hendrix, if you were a guitar player. And then, of course, you had to go back and listen to who Clapton and Hendrix listened to.
Well, the Muzzleloaders is clearly a blues rock band.
The Muzzleloaders, you heard us, so you know. Yes, we're definitely not a blues band.
No.
But you're right, we're a blues-oriented rock band. And I wrote most of the songs that we're doing right now. And for years wanted to play again, and when I finally became the business agent of the Stagehands Union, it allowed me to have evenings available, and I got together with some of the, who I think are some of the better players in Columbus, and we formed this band.
So your songwriting now, were you able to have a songwriting role or in your earlier bands with the James Gang or otherwise, were you more of a player?
Yes, no, I was always a songwriter in every band I've been in. In every band I've been in that did originals. You know, early on, we just did cover songs. Once I started writing songs, I've written songs not to say I was the only writer, but I've always written songs in every band I've been in since I started writing songs.
To get to one of the things that I most want to talk to you about, because I already know, have a sense of where we're going with some of this. You've, especially once you started doing the shows with the James Gang, because of the kinds of people you could associate with, in the mid-70s, in the heyday of rock and roll, with the people most famous for rock and roll, you have some stories of what it was like to be on the road, for good, bad, or otherwise, but it seems like mostly for good. what can you tell us about some of the surprising stories that were true as you interacted with Alice Cooper or other famous folk?
Well, okay, I'll have to think here. With Alice, we did a tour with Alice Cooper, Vincent Fernier, that's his real name. And, you know, he's a Detroit guy, and he was a good guy. I imagine he still is. I haven't seen him in many years. But we went and did Welcome to My Nightmare tour. And, you know, they had all this Disney design.
Theatrical.
Very theatrical. And we were the opening band, and he was great. He took care of us. There was a bottle of champagne in the room and all this kind of stuff. And one night we were playing in Providence, Rhode Island. And there's a part of his set where he is sitting there singing to this oversized box of toys. And he's singing, "All My Toys Are Dead," and all this stuff. And these dancers, at a certain point, the box opens up and these dancers would come out. Well, we decided as a joke that maybe we would get in the box, we being a couple of the guys in the James Gang and myself. So we talked to the dancers about it, and this was right near the end of the tour, and they said, okay, that would be good. Well, I had about 5 beers, so I was blasted, and we got into this box, and the scene is he's singing about all his toys, and at a certain point, the box opens up, the dancers come out, and we're supposed to hand him a letter sweater, And then he takes it and goes into schools out for summer. Okay. So his back is to the audience. So the box, we're looking, as the box opens up, we come out of the box, we can see the audience, but he's looking back at us. And when he sees us come out of the box, he just flips. He, at that point, he picks his nose and wipes it on me. Alice thought that was real funny. So I handed him a sweater. They rolled the box off, you know, and that was our big gag with Alice, you know, and then he busted our chops about that for the next, you know, whatever few days. But that was the kind of stuff that, you know, it was fun. You know, we would usually do about 35 minutes. We'd open up for him, and we were a rock band. We got out and rocked. When he came on, it was the huge full tilt scenery laden, you know, deal. And he had a couple terrific guitar players with him, guys from a band called Frost, Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter. Actually had a really good band behind him. It was Lou Reed's old band, and these guys could really rock. So people that thought, well, it's Alice and he's just kind of doing show rock, but really they got to hear a really terrific rock band behind him at the time. So that was good fun. And you know, we traveled on a turboprop, private turboprop. There was like 50 or 60 of us on there the whole tour. So it was kind of wild on the plane. I can't really get into all those stories. I'm married.
Mm-hmm. Are there some artists you most especially liked working with, that you were especially surprised that in the same way that maybe Alice Cooper, I got the impression that when he was done on stage, he said, all right, you know, I know that's an act, and then he's a normal person backstage.
Absolutely.
Did you have other people that you were pleasantly surprised by in that way?
Let me think.
Or maybe the opposite, if you want to dish the dirt.
We toured with Kiss. They were nice guys. You know, they really were. They were nice guys. You know, I remember, I think it was Paul Stanley came up to me and said, our manager told us that if we just kept us up, we're going to all get rich. Hmm? And their manager was...
very right.
Very correct. Right. So we did ZZ Top. We did some shows with them.
But you were you able to find and establish a kind of musician to musician level that was different than musician to crew, musician to fan, different from all of those other things where you could be cool on a peer level?
Honestly, not that much. A part of that was a function of just the fact that we came in from one direction, they came in from another. They dropped us off, we did a sound check. They took us back to our hotel. Later on, we came back, we played. If we liked the band, we'd stay and watch. Otherwise, we might stay at different hotels. So a lot of times it was just catch as catch can. I didn't get a chance to sit and jam with guys like I would have had it been more of a local scene. But when you're on tour like that, it just didn't present itself too often.
That's the difference between the reality and that perception that the audience might have about what it's really like.
Right. Now, I know that sometimes, because a lot of times we're thrown on a tour that the main band didn't really have that much. Now, you know, Clapton goes out and he chooses who he wants to open for him. And usually it's somebody that he really likes and he'll bring that guy on and that guy will do it. Like Robert Cray. Last time Clapton was in town, I know Cray opened up for him. And then, of course, later on, Cray came out and did a song with him. That wasn't going, especially with somebody like Alice, whose show was so directed to his own thing. It wasn't going to work for us to come up and jam a couple tunes with him. But I do, you know, I remember spending a couple hours in John McLaughlin's dressing, in his hotel room. I had an old Gibson Flying V guitar, which was a rare guitar, and got on an elevator with him. He asked me what that was. I told him, he said, boy, I'd love to play that guitar. Well, I was a big fan of John McLaughlin from Mahavishnu Orchestra, so I went up to his room and sat there and watched him play my guitar for an hour, and I was just like, wow, you know, John McLaughlin.
Yeah, so there's something to being able to run into Rod Stewart and his girlfriend and other famous people and running into famous people and interacting with them always, it produced a variety of results.
Yeah, there's some, I mean, I can think of a few. I remember being at the airport in Atlanta and running into ZZ Top, and they come up to us and go, hey, James Gang. And we say, hey, guys, ZZ Top. I love ZZ. He says, you want to see some pictures? I say, sure. Figure for sure they're going to show us pictures of women. He's got a bunch of pictures of food, Mexican dishes. He says, now, if you get a tamale, you have to go to this place in Austin. And if you get, you know, if you really want frijoles, you got to go here. And then when we walked away, I remember talking to the band, I'm going, am I nuts? This guy just showed me like 12 pictures of food. I've never had anyone show me pictures of, and obviously they had them actually in a notebook. It's like, this is
food porn.
Yeah, this is different, right? Food rock. This is a whole new thing, you know. And
Now you and I know this through stagehands, people touring with Broadway or rock shows. Those guys talk amongst themselves about where to get the best food in the respective places and the cheapest hotels and their little road gossip. So I presume that was your early exposure to road gossip. People that had been on the road so damn much, they just, at this point, they cared more about a burrito than they did about some getting some strange.
Well, anybody who's been on the road knows that your meal is, I mean, nowadays, you know, everybody carries chefs with them. When I go to see my friend Alan, who's the head of Dylan, you know, he tells me people don't try to steal the Dylan's guitar player. They try to steal his cook. This woman, she cooks all this phenomenal food. That wasn't going on back then. So when you're on the road, if you got a great meal, that was your little respite. Not only the food was good, but that was your time away from all the, but I got to sit down and have that great burrito. And yeah, guys would tell you, hey, if you're in Austin, you got to go to here. If you're in San Francisco, you got to go there. So we would always try the, you know.
I'd like to still believe that there was some road box somewhere in the truck loaded with the Polaroids of the local breasts. Because I've seen that in the tours coming. And I have to believe it existed somewhere in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, there was one guy, I can't remember who he was, but he had a stack. He must have had 300 photos of naked girls from different gigs. You know, that was his collection, you know. Show us your set, you know, and there they were for the world to see.
This is an odd question. If you traveled to the same place again, did you try to reconnect with some of those same particular girls?
Well, only if they showed up. In other words, again, you pull into a town, you go from the hotel to the place, do a sound check, back to the hotel, back to the hall for the gig, back to the hotel, back to the plane and gone. You really had no time on your own. You weren't, you know. Now, I've seen stories with some of these acts where they, you know, where they'd send a guy down and there'd be all these girls down there and it was like, okay, you're too young. You, okay, you two can go up and, you know, we weren't that organized. You know, we weren't that organized. You know, we weren't love magnets like some of the boy bands are, you know, so. You know, I would love to tell you about all these fabulous things, but that really wasn't the case for us too much. I mean, every once in a while there'd be a tale, but for the most part for us, we just, that wasn't so much in the cards for us. We were not a pretty boy band.
Yeah, but you
to
also,
say the least.
Now you continued up with the practical jokes because you still were into, especially with the acts that you did multiple shows with. You guys got comfortable with each other,
right?
And you would have to do things to keep it fresh and keep yourselves amused. And it was the normal schoolboy pranks, you know, extended on through rock and roll history.
It's true. I mean, I told you the story earlier about Alice and us being in the toy box for the Welcome to My Nightmare tour. There was another time where we were on the beach and we were sitting there and Alice, Vincent during the day. Remember, he only became Alice once he put his makeup on. He was Vinny during the day. And we had this big semi-burnt log that was sitting on the beach. And he had a couple of his guys move it over to where we were sitting. And then we had it moved over to where he was sitting. And this went back and forth. And that was done. And he left. We stayed on the beach. And I got a couple of the roadies to grab this, you know, 7-foot, 110-pound log and take it to the gig. And then when we were done, I had him put the log out there on the stage over on like stage left. And the first thing Alice comes out, he looks over at the log and one end of it was burnt. And he started to laugh. He pretended he was mad, but I could tell he was laughing because he immediately recognized
that. That's the log from the beach.
That's the log from the beach. And these are the things that are, you know, this is, it's fun. It would make, you know, because really, the one thing about being on the road that people forget is when you play a club, when you're and you're a local musician, you go to a club and, you know, you play, you might play for 3 hours. Here for Alice, when we opened up, we did our 35, 40 minute set. You travel for hours, your hotels, all the stuff, and the payoff is very short. There's that short 40 minutes. So you try to make more, you know, that's your big fun is when you're playing, but since it's not very long, you try to make fun in other ways just so you can, you know, not go road weary nuts. Oh, I remember one. We were in the Chicago airport and we were waiting for a plane and we ran into the Four Tops. And right then a big band was the Average White Band, if you remember them. I think they were out of either England or Scotland. So the guys in the Four Tops, they come up to us, and that was a white band that all the black acts really liked because they were very soulful, cut the cake. So Levi Stubbs from the Four Tops comes up and goes, "Are you guys the Average White Band?" And Jimmy Fox, our drummer, goes, "No, we're an Average White Band." So I thought that was a good quick line on his part, you know, so a little comedy there. Maybe very little, but that's what we got.
Are there any of the well-known people that you found yourself keeping in touch with, or do you find that now that you're not active in those bands, that is just kind of going into a sepia-toned past?
Yeah, that's exactly kind of what it did. Now, I have one friend who was my guitar tech, if you want to. Back then, a guitar tech, man, the guy took your guitar and handed it to you. Nowadays, you know, they're changing strings on 46 guitars and, you know, and polishing the guitar. Back then it was, but a guy named Alan Santos, who is now the head of production for Bob Dylan and has for about the last 10 years. So whenever Dylan comes in town, I get together with Alan and, you know, he's Dylan's head guy. And it's kind of nice for us to reminisce about when, you know, he was a lowly guitar tech and now he lives on the island of Kauai in Hawaii and is Dylan's number one man.
Doesn't sound like a bad gig.
No, it's not. It's one of the choice gigs. And, you know, certain people, you know, I was in a band in L.A., and we were handled by the same people that handled War, and we did a bunch of gigs with War. You know, I don't know if anybody remembers War. They did Slipping in a Darkness, Lowrider. Some of those songs, they were kind of a funk rock.
Oh, Lowrider's a perennial favorite.
Yeah, Lowrider, they still play. They still play Lowrider. It's kind of a cool song. And so we did some things with them. I remember going to a party in L.A. The guy used to cut hair, Rick Thixton. I haven't thought about him in a million years. And he had a local band. He had a band playing in his house. It was a regular three-bedroom house. And here's a band with a set up Marshalls, you know, in this living room. And it turned out it was Van Halen, you know, and they were nobody at the time. But it was the Van Halen, the same Van Halen everybody knows, just playing in this guy's living room. And I remember thinking after the party, I don't even know what they were called. I don't think they were called Van Halen, but I remember thinking after I left, they go, "Wow, those guys were really good." You know, usually don't see a band at a party that's that good, you know. And then when I see Van Halen breaking, I go, "Wait a minute, that's the band I saw at the haircutter's party," you know. So figure that out.
Yeah, even the Beatles and Rolling Stones and stuff, they had to be some local band at one point in time.
Every single body starts out as a local body, and that's just how it is. And that's why, you know, it's funny when you travel the country, any town you go to, if you go to Austin or it doesn't matter where you go, somebody will say, "Oh, you need to go down to the Club 55 and hear Joe Blow," and whatever. And you go down and hear Joe Blow, and he's unbelievable. There's an unbelievable guy in every town. There really is. And anywhere you go, there's somebody who's really tearing it up. And some of them are going to get famous, and most of them aren't. And Columbus has those guys too. You know, I mean, there's always somebody to knock you out. You know, little legendary local legends.
So now we're talking about business, so that's the right time to segue. The first thing I'm going to ask you about, because I'm going to just nosily pry into your wallet. I'm just going to start with that.
Go right ahead.
So you've worked with two different labels. You've done touring where at the, you know, you were in a very known band, you know, that put out a number of releases that opened for big acts. What things did or didn't make you money as you look back in time? Did I'll say at the time it was albums, it wasn't CDs or downloads. You know, did albums make you money? Do you still get residuals on things like CDs or downloads? Did you make money on the live shows? Did you make money on the merchandise? Do you make any money now, residual wise, or how did any of that actually play out in reality?
It all played out to this. I didn't make crap. But in the early days, when I was on United Artists with this band I had in L.A. called Uncle Tom, of all bands, you know, the record didn't sell much. And had it sold much back then, I realized now we signed our lives away. So that would have been a bad deal. A lot of times what happens with acts is their first time out, they sign a deal that's not very good. And then, because most acts don't have a hit. And for the few acts that do have a hit, most of them only have one hit. So if you sign a poor deal for your one good shot, then you get screwed, because then, you know, then when you finally get it together. Now, everybody knows, like, Bruce Springsteen, you know, he got screwed for a while, but then, of course, he was going to become this major monster act. So eventually it catches up with itself. With the James Gang, you know, I mean, honestly, I was after Joe Walsh and Tommy Bolin. And the first few months we played, they were still saying, well, where's Joe? Well, Joe hadn't been in the band in a while. Well, where's Tommy? Well, he hadn't been in the band for a while. So the band had already actually peaked. Even though we played a lot of great gigs, it's kind of hard to bring it back. There's been a few bands, Aerosmith and a few, who had that up, kind of went down, and then went up even actually higher. With us, that wasn't the case. We did a lot of great touring, but
But you still do know Joe Walsh.
Oh, absolutely. I've known Joe from the Cleveland days. When he was a local, he used to have a band called the Measles. And Joe was talented back then, you know. And I've talked to him a few times. He was in town with the Ringo Starr and the All-Stars, which was Joe and Ringo and Todd Rundgren and Dave Edmonds from Rockpile and Burton Cummings from a Canadian band that I can't even think of right now. But I knew Joe. One time I saw Joe, he was so out of it, he didn't even know he was talking to me. Then he went to AA and got off everything, and now he's clear-minded. So, yeah, I mean, I've known Joe. I lent him a guitar in 1968, so you figure it out. Don't even add it up. It's too long.
I'm gonna take a moment just to talk about some studio experience. You've had the opportunity to work with, well, you've certainly been in the studio, and there's one engineer in particular that I want to ask you about. You know where I'm heading with this.
Yeah, Tom Dowd.
Must have been interesting. What do you think about working with Tom Dowd?
Well, you know, I remember in Cleveland when we recorded.
And can I also ask,
sure,
with respect to other engineers that you've worked with, not to slam them, they may be good at whatever they were good at, but what was it like working with Tom Dowd, and especially in comparison to working with the other engineers? What's the comparison?
Well, let me start by saying I had the fortune of picking him up from the airport in Cleveland. He lived in Florida. And I picked him up on a gray, ugly day. And I remember the first thing he said to me is, what do you people do in this town? Because he used to go fishing and go sailing and ride his bike on the coast. And Cleveland, if anybody's been to Cleveland, they know it stays gray for about 8 or 9 months a year. So, but, you know, he got in the car and I'm taking him back to the studio. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is Tom Dowd. This is the guy. This guy did Aretha Franklin. This guy did Cream.
The Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
Eric Clapton.
Everybody. Those, yeah. And he was a great guy. Just a very personable person. He treated everyone the same, whether you were Eric Clapton or you were Joe Blow. I mean, he really had a respect for people that was very impressive. And I think what strikes me about Tom as maybe being different than other engineers I'd had contact with, many of them really good engineers too, is that Tom had the combination of being technically adept, more than adept, technically brilliant, but also he was a soul man. He had that connection. He knew when a person was giving their most soulful performance, whether it was a guitar solo, whether it was a vocal. And he, I remember asking him about a solo. I asked him, I says, how does Clapton approach a solo before I was going to put a solo down? And he told me, he says, Eric used to say that he wanted a very strong intro and a very strong outro. So his first few notes were very important to him on a solo. And then the way he ended the solo, those last few notes, he said, and usually when he, if he did more than one take or five takes, the very first bar or two and the very last bar would be the same each time. And then the whole middle of the solo every time would be different, because he would, he had enough confidence in himself to improvise during that solo. But he wanted that, you know, if you listen to something like Sunshine of Your Love and you hear that intro, you know that that is a very powerful, it grabs people's attention. Then he would go off and wail. And then in the out, he wanted to leave you with something. And I always kept that with me, that thought about, okay, somebody's going to let me play a little solo here, whether it's 4 bars, 12 bars, or 40 bars. I want to make sure I get their attention from the note one. Hendrix was the same way, hit you with that powerful note. And Dowd, you know, he would relate to Aretha Franklin. He'd say, you know, how each performance she did just got better and better and better. And I'm thinking, here I am, this guitar player from Cleveland, and here's this guy who has recorded with the people that I've listened to my whole life. Just, he was an amazing, amazing person. And I mean, you know, his body of work speaks for itself. Like you say, the Allman Brothers, the Cream, on and on and on, Aretha Franklin, just so many great records that he did. And it didn't matter if it was a heavy rock or if it was a blues or if it was a rhythm and blues act. He could always get, to me, a producer, because he was a producer and an engineer, he could get to the essence of that artist. He could hear in his mind, like I remember he used to tell me, a lot of times a vocalist will do a track. He always would tell the guy, let's do a practice track, but he'd run the tape, because a lot of times when a guy's doing a rehearsal, sort of a practice track, he's real loose and he's not all uptight, he thinks he's not running the tape, and a lot of times he'll give his best performance then. And he used to talk about how the vocalist would say, I want to do it again, I want to do it again, I had a flat note, I had a sharp note. And finally, by the 12th time the vocalist has put down his thing, okay, the vocalist feels pretty good about it. Every note is, there's no sharps, no flats. But meanwhile, Tom is thinking, yeah, and there's also no soul. You know, now you've gotten it. So, and he called it an experiment in vocalese. You know, so it's like, you're supposed to be, when you record, you're supposed to be getting that performance, that great performance. And it's up to him as a producer to recognize when he used to say, okay, your ears are gone. You know, in the band, we go, we want to know, you're done. You guys are shot. You think you're getting better, but you're actually getting worse. Time to go home. We'll start tomorrow. And I think that's what set him apart from a lot of other guys, is he could feel when it was there and when it's not. A lot of times, that's why there's a producer there. Musicians, even great musicians, don't often know when they're at their best. And you get a guy like that to trust, you know, he will...
To introduce some objectivity.
Exactly. To it. And he knew. He just, he was something else.
Did he get very involved with the arranging? Did he get very involved in helping you plot out things like the solos?
He was involved in everything. If he liked something the way it was, he'd say, okay, that's, that I pretty much like the way, or, but he would say, hey, have you thought about, well, let's do that second verse. Let's do part of that again, and then we'll just do a little 4-bar solo. He would give us ideas on how to go about things, and he was just an artist has to trust the person that they're with, because let's face it, a live gig is one thing. You know, it's done. Out to the next live gig, and unless it was recorded, you can remember a gig for being better than it really was, or maybe you think it was worse than it really was, but once it goes down, back then it was on vinyl, now it's digital, but there it is. And, you know, Tom used to say, no postmortems. So meaning, you know, it's over with. I don't want to hear you bitch about this or it's done. It's done. For better or for worse, we've closed the book on that particular tune. Let's move on. No postmortems.
How did he approach motivating the band if he needed to, or how did he approach the balance between helping move things along and staying out of the way?
I think that he just, for us, he just sort of let us do our thing. You know, with some bands, I've been in bands where the singer's very sensitive. And if you don't treat him right, he's going to go off and sulk. And a lot of times you need a producer to understand, okay, this guy's very moody and I can only get a performance out of him when he's had a couple glasses of wine and he's loosened out.
Did Tom spend, for instance, or the, any of the other engineers you've worked with, did they spend a lot of pre-planning time getting to know the band personally, seeing you in live shows, listening to releases? What was the getting to know each other part of it?
He really didn't spend a lot of time doing that. I think, as I recall, it's been a long time that we sent him some tapes, probably rehearsal hall tapes, of just here's some of the songs. You know, usually when a band puts 8 or 9 or 10 cuts on a CD or an album, as it was back then, they have more than that ready. And then, you know, you might have 20 songs and you pick the best 9. It's very rare that, okay, here's our 9 songs. It's very rare that anyone's going to think all 9 of those are good, is good enough to go on a thing. So I believe we sent him live tapes we had of us, not so much gigs, but in rehearsal halls. Here's some of the songs we're thinking about doing. We had an acoustic song. You know, he suggested that we put I remember we had one song we put cello and, I think it was cello and harmonica with some strange back. And, he would have ideas. Like, I remember recording an album down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama with this one band I had with a guy named Rick Hall. And Rick Hall had the Muscle Shoals sound. And I walked into his office and he had about 50 gold records on his wall. And Rick was
saves
one of these,
on wallpaper, doesn't
he? Yeah. And he was a guy who was very involved in, and he had done with Tom Dowd. Him and Tom Dowd actually worked on Aretha Franklin's earliest records. But Rick was a very involved to the point of he'd come in the studio and play an instrument. He'd sing background if he were, you know. He was totally involved. Other producers just sort of sit and let it happen. Again, it depends on the band. Some bands have a very strong grip on what they want to do. They know what they want to do. I mean, I remember even with George Martin, when they used to ask George Martin about the Beatles, and they always said, well, George, obviously you were the one who did this, and he'd say, no, that was, you know, I just helped them improve on it, but that was Lennon's idea, or that was McCartney's idea. I mean, so I think it always depends upon the band. Some bands have one creative guy that sort of leads everyone.
So
other bands are completely creative, you know.
But at Muscle Shoals, did it happen that he was that involved in what you guys were doing?
He was so involved that I had a band that was sort of a combination between a rock band and a rhythm and blues band. And Rick pushed it, and because he was more of a rhythm and blues guy, we were really probably 75% rock and 25% rhythm and blues. And by the time he was done with us, we were 75% rhythm and blues and 25% rock. So he really
that push might not even have been
proper.
It wasn't
right. It really wasn't for our band. But he felt that's where he was coming from, and he felt that you know, he back then we were very young, and he was a strong personality, and he just took us over. You know, that was all. We were in awe most of the time we were there. None of us had been hardly at all in a studio. And
I presume that's part of this not intentionally intimidating things. The studios try to legitimize themselves, and they put up the gold records and set themselves up as the places where it happens. There's also the intimidation as a result.
Right. You know, and I think that where you are in your musical maturation process, it's like if you see a person who's, it's like in any other business, you say, geez, this guy's got 50 gold singles on his roll. He obviously knows what he's doing. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. You know, we got some songs here we wrote, so let's listen to him and we'll get a gold record.
Somebody said with folks like Britney Spears, her personal turmoil aside, I think she's made some odd music choices as time has went by. And I wonder if that relates to the idea that starting as a Mouseketeer, she fell prey to the same thing. She goes into, you know, you're a kid, here's the experts, the producers, and she's told what to do. And then as she grows through her career, she never grows out of being told what to do because she's relied on the experts for so long, and that she never came into having real say-so of her own.
I think that's true. That's why some of the bands who developed on their own, they played clubs, they wrote songs, they produced or arranged their own songs for whatever it was worth, they at least learned how to think on their feet. And sometimes you're right and sometimes you're not. And I think the boy bands and the Britney Spears and stuff, they're basically sort of a creation of the producer. It's almost more the producer's medium than it is the artist. And as a matter of fact, I think some of the people that wrote Britney's songs wrote the Backstreet Boys songs. And there was some connection there. And these guys could really knew how to write a 3.5-minute pop song. Got some guys who looked good and sang good, made it work. Same thing with Britney. She looked good. She knew how to dance. And they made it happen. You're not going to do that when you get Radiohead in the studio. That's not going to happen, because Radiohead, and I just grabbed that band. I mean, they're brilliant. And they're, you know, a lot of times the best thing for a producer to do is say, way to go, guys.
Did you have any bad days in the studios, I'll call, whether it's the fault of your own overindulgences of the 70s, whether it's the fact of producers or weird studio environments? I mean, when you look back at it now, from the perspective of a band in the studio, what were the kinds of things that would make it made it difficult for you in the times that it was?
Well, I can think of a situation where we brought in this cellist who was a classically trained cellist. He was wonderful. And he got in the studio and he started sweating bullets. He just couldn't perform once the engineer turned the mic on. Completely freaked out. I'd heard the guy play earlier, sounded great. Came in the studio and he just fell
froze.
Apart. Froze. And couldn't get out of it. We tried, you know, Tom asked the guys to leave. Let's let him do it. He got himself psyched out. Another time I was in a session where someone pulled out a tie stick, if anyone remembers what that is. That was the end of the session. I mean, people were just babbling. I've been at sessions where the bass player's girlfriend says, I'm not sure I like that song. All of a sudden, all these, you know, insecure musicians are doubting what they're doing. And next thing you know, we're taking a song that we'd worked on and we're dumping it because the bass player's girlfriend didn't like it. So insecurity can reign sometimes. And that's why I think when you see, it's like an athlete. Athletes, you know, not sure about how good he is. All of a sudden, he does a few things good on the field. Now, all of a sudden, now he's feeling good about himself. Now he can really come into his own. I think it's true with musicians, too.
Did you have any of the same problems live? Or did the bass player's girlfriend's opinions not even matter in the live shows?
Live always seems to take care of itself. Unless there's really a problem in the band, you got a guy who's a drug addict or somebody's an alcoholic. I mean, not to say that everybody didn't try everything, but I'm just saying if you get someone in the band who gets so out of it that they can no longer perform on their instrument, then you can have yourself a real problem. But generally, in most bands, live has never been a problem unless there's a malfunction in the, you know, in the sound or something like that. You just sort of get out there and go, especially if you're a player.
You are a player. Do you enjoy the smaller club? You've had a taste of the big gigs. Do you enjoy the little bar gigs now as much or less than? I mean, or was there some glory to be playing in a stadium in the middle of the 70s with Kiss? Was there some glory that's just, you know, unobtainable now?
Yes, I will say there is. I remember playing at the Maple Leaf. Was it in Montreal? Is that Maple Leaf Gardens? We played with Alice Cooper there. I think it was like about a 20,000 seat thing. And I remember thinking, oh my God, check this out. And it was very cool. For myself, I love playing clubs because it's intimate. I love playing theaters. This 18,000 seat thing is, you know, it just is what it is. I don't get that much more of a charge out of 18,000 people than 300 people. I mean, you talk about the band, the Muzzleloaders. You were there at the gig. There was, what, a couple hundred people there? 300? I don't know how many people are in that club.
250, 300, something
like
that.
Okay, so to me, that was just as much fun as any huge thing. You can look at people in the eye, people you know, the band's jamming, everything's going off good. I used to love to play theaters, you know, a place that holds 2,200 people, 2,400 people, because it's still a good sound man can still get you a really good sound in there. It's big enough that you got a couple thousands or so people there, but yet it's intimate enough that, you know, that was my favorite, was playing a proscenium theater. A place like the Ohio Theater, you know, there's places like that all over the country. And I used to really love to play those kind of places. But I love playing clubs too. As long as it's not, I mean, I've played some clubs where the stage isn't big enough to hold the guys in the band. As long as you're comfortable standing up there and there's a decent sound system, I like playing clubs. It's, you know, it's fun. Now the money, you know, I mean, clearly if you can fill up those big places, you're going to make a lot more money than you're going to play in a small place or in a club, you know, so.
And you don't have to give any details, but the stories about sex, drugs, and rock and rolls with big bands in the 70s, would you say they're on target?
Yeah, I would say they're on target. I mean, you know, there's a quote from We're an American Band. You remember that song by Grand Funk Railroad? We're an American Band, and they sing about Little Rock Connie. And sweet, sweet Connie, she did her
We're act. Coming to your town. We'd love to party down.
Right.
We're
an American Band. She did the whole band, and that's a natural fact. We're an American Band. Well, we ran into Connie. I'd heard about Connie, and Connie was for real. There she was. Real life Connie, and Pam DeBar and some of these others, you know, the world famous groupies. Yeah, I mean, I saw some
there
stuff.
There is like some plaster cast of your penis somewhere, oh,
yeah.
Is there?
Yeah, there are plaster casters. Now, I never
personally. Yeah, but not of you.
Not me, but yeah, the plaster casters were absolutely out there. There were three heavyset girls who, you know, took plaster casts of guys, and that was a... That was a thing that was going on, and it was pretty.
Is any
that makes me laugh? To
should
think
I
about
even
it.
Ask? Is that even in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? You know,
I'm embarrassed to say, being from Cleveland, I've never been at the Rock and Roll. I've been to the Baseball Hall of Fame, but I've never been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I mean, there's a part of me that thinks that the plaster casters were pretty legendary fans, and you know, you got to give a nod to them. I'm not sure if. What kind of shelf space they're getting up in Cleveland right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's an exhibit for them, but, you know, hey, you can never tell. You know, anything can... I remember we played a few dates with Rod Stewart and the Faces, and they had nothing but beautiful women around them. It was just unbelievable. One beautiful woman after another. Every guy in the band had a beautiful woman. And then Rod Stewart was going with Britt Eklund at the time, and she showed up, and all of a sudden all the beautiful women looked like high school girls, because then a really beautiful, you know, Britt Eklund was a movie star. And it was like, I was just thinking, I'm just this guitar player from Cleveland, you know, who are these people? You know, of course Rod's still out there, you know, doing his Rod Stewart thing.
There's a David, you're making me think there's a Dave Attell joke about that. He said, finally, my fantasy came true about doing a line off of a stripper's ass, except in my fantasy, it didn't include smell. and in my fantasy, the stripper wasn't text messaging her boyfriend at the time.
Yeah. That's good. I like that. That's very good.
You're enjoying playing now.
I'm loving it. I'm just loving it.
And tell us more about the Muzzle Loaders.
Well, the Muzzle Loaders are a group of Columbus guys who I got together with. Three of us have other jobs. I'm the business agent for the Stagehands Union. Andy Harrison, the guitar player with myself, is Cheryl Crow's guitar tech and travels the world with her. And our lead singer, Jimmy Edwards, is a rigger. He rigs for me. He goes up, and if anybody who knows the business.
Jim Casto and drums.
Jimmy, well, the other three guys, though, the drummer, the bass player, and the organ player, they do nothing but play music. So, you know, when we formed this band, I told them, I says, guys, this isn't going to be about money. because this isn't going to be a band that's playing three nights a week. So we've got Jimmy Casto on drums, terrific local drummer, a guy named Bill Zanel on bass, wonderful bass player. Nate Holman on Hammond B3, he's terrific.
Are you looking at strictly as not a business move to maintain your enjoyment of it?
No. I'm open for anything. You know, if somebody came up and said, hey, I want you guys to record an album or I want you guys to go on tour, I'd definitely talk about it. You know, we're not pointed in that direction because everybody has so many other projects. But, you know, I'm open for whatever. So we're just going to go out and play and enjoy it. It seems like the people that have come to hear us like us. And we'll just see what happens. But I don't have any big business aspirations. This is
my wife came out to see it with me, and at a certain point she looks over at me 4 or 5 songs in, and she just earnestly says, "Do you think these guys are good?" I go, "Yeah." And this is their second gig. They're solid. And she goes, "That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure you were thinking that." you would have to know. She was very, very serious. Just wanted to feel me out to see what it was, like a surprisingly tight set.
Do you think that
in today's environment, and I don't know how much you stick your nose around labels and A&R people and worry about that now, because you've sure been there. And how much you worry about that now. Do you think that there's things about the internet and the changes in the industry that would make it better, harder, easier, more difficult for you to get real sales or to really do a tour now than there was in the middle of the 70s?
I have to admit, I feel sort of like a dinosaur on the business end of it, even though I run a stagehands union. The whole industry has changed. I think the record business is about done. I really believe that. I think in 3 or 4 years there are going to be no more CDs.
I mean, it might be the case that everything you knew about the industry from its heyday in the 70s might be so different now that those experiences don't translate to useful information now. I don't know.
Yeah, and I don't either, really. And my son has a band called
Starving Goliath.
Thank you, Starving Goliath. And they have put their music on the internet, and a lot of guys are self-promoting, and everybody knows Radiohead just, you know, release their own thing and let people pay what they wanted for it. So the record industry is flipping over. And I think, it used to be back in the day that these labels would go out, they'd sign 10, 12 bands, and they'd front you money to do a CD, an album. If you made money, the first $200,000 you made went back to pay for what it cost to make your, and if one of those bands made it, it covered the expense of the other ones. It's a whole different world now. It's a whole different ball game.
What do you think about the differences between watching what Starving Goliath is doing to promote itself and what you've had to do?
Well, I think, like you and I were speaking, off microphone here, I think that the record business now, to me, I had an A&R guy tell me, he says, I used to get tapes from songwriters of a guy who was a out-of-tune guitar, out-of-tune voice, but he wrote a great song. So he would take the song, take it to an artist, go into the studio and have a hit record. He says, now with everyone owning studios and everybody having digitally this and digital, I get a CD from someone, all the sounds are great, but there's no song there. And I don't think the artists are spending enough time. I think they're spending a lot of time with technology and not enough time writing the song.
I understand that there's a much smaller pool of people who are even able to make any money as songwriters, that a lot of artists are taking it upon themselves to try to write songs, and as a result, you might find yourself losing the quality when there was people who were really good at it who were able to be funded because of the way that the industry was set up.
Well, you've heard of the Peter Principles. The Peter Principle is you rise to your own level of incompetence. So if you say, hey, you know what, I'm a great sound engineer, I think I'll design my own CD cover, as opposed to letting a guy who's good at that do that. And I think people have a hard time knowing what they're good at. And I don't see the direction out there. I don't know. I think the whole industry is changing. And
in that way, the good news about the internet and being able to self-release is more people are empowered to put stuff out. You can buy some recording tools more cheaply, and there you can find some audience, maybe. The bad news is these same people aren't getting advice. They're not getting help from professional studios, professional photographers, professional producers, professional songwriters. And so even if they take the Superman approach that we can do it all, save the money, and but they're not really trimming off just the fat. They're trimming off a lot of the meat too.
Exactly.
And they're suffering from their lack of objective help.
Right. And I think if you talk to people from back in the day, they'll tell you when a new album came out, you got together with your buddy. You took the album, you put it on, and then you studied the cover for an hour. While you listened to the album, you read every word on that album. Now the CDs, you know, it doesn't present itself in an artistic way the way a whatever size an album is, 12 by 10 or whatever it is, you know, a 12 by 12, 14, whatever. You know, you could put a lot more on an album cover than you can on a little square CD cover. And I think that...
It's certainly being viewed much more as a commodity now. You know, music is what's underneath, you know, a commercial. It's not an end in and of itself.
You're not going to have somebody sell 24 million CDs like you did. You know, if you look at what guys used to sell, 5 million, 8 million, 7 million, 11 million, that's not happening anymore. And granted, you got everybody and their brother. It's just like karaoke. Everyone and their brother can put out a CD or can release on the internet, release their music. And at the risk, again, of sounding like a dinosaur, but I do have a son who's, you know, just like I turned him on to The Who, and he turned me on to Radiohead, you know, so we got that back and forth thing going. I'm kind of disappointed with what I'm, you know, when I put on the radio, I think it's pretty disappointing. And you have to struggle to hear something good or more important, something new. Everything is so derivative. And, I'm always looking for something. I'm not one of these guys that sit around and listen to The Who and listen to old stuff. I want to hear new music. I want to hear music that's going to get me off the way The Who did when I first heard them. And occasionally, like I mentioned Radiohead because they're a band that I really like a lot, even though it's not at all what I play. I love what they do. I think they're one of the few truly original creative acts around. And I'm always looking for... I like Wilco. I find them to be an interesting band. They're different than everyone else. And I'm always looking for that new act, but I just don't hear a lot of it. I wish, you know, I'm waiting to hear the new thing that's going to really get me going. But I don't know. I think we're in a little bit of a lull right now where it's just not, you know, something will happen though. Something always pops. Everybody's, all the good stuff has been done. I never believe that. There's some act right now in some garage or in some club that are getting ready to release something that someday...
The next Van Halen playing in somebody's living room.
Exactly. Somebody that's going to completely knock us out that we had no idea was going to do it. And that's the exciting part, is hearing something. You go, wow, I've never heard anything. I can maybe hear their influences, but I've never heard anything exactly like that before. And that's...
So do you even find yourself trying to advise your son about the business of the music business, or do you just let them do what they're doing because it's so much of a new approach?
When they ask me for advice, which isn't that often, but when they do, it's never musical advice. They're very creative arrangements. They've got I strictly talk to them about trying to be professional. When you're on stage, don't spend 5 minutes between a tune unless you're doing something entertaining out there. You know, this hem-hawing around. Don't break a string and not have another guitar sitting there. Don't be on the ground looking for a guitar pick, that kind of stuff. Look, be a pro, get out there and knock it out for people. That's the kind of stuff I tell them. As far as their music is their music. They're totally their own, and I think they're real original. And I
just want to key off of that for a second now. Is there anything you learned about shows or preparation or showmanship from doing the bigger shows that you wouldn't have figured out if you were always only in the bars?
Yes. Pete Townshend once told us that when he played for a large audience, a lot of times what happens is guys who are used to playing in clubs, they're used to playing for 50 people, 100 people. So they go into a hall that holds 17,000 people, and they're staring at those front four rows because that's what they relate to, and you're sort of cutting out the audience. What Pete says is he would focus on a face 40 rows out. And I learned to do that, where you'd look out, and even though it's kind of a blur, you just look out there and smile at someone. And people, and I've been in the audience where I think, geez, I think that guy just looked at me and smiled at me. And that's kind of, you can connect with people that way. So what you do is you need to play for the people in the back row. If you play for the people far back, if you can get them, you're going to be bigger than life to the people in the first 30 rows. But you can't just focus on those people out front and leave people in the balcony and in the back out. So that's, you know, when Pete did the Birdman and swung his arms big and all that kind of stuff, that's for the greater audience. You know, you got to do something big because, you know, when you're in the back row, you know, as a sound guy, a lot of times you're in the back. People are real little. You know, they're only a couple inches high when you're looking back there. So you've got to, it's trying to reach. That's one thing you do learn from playing at a big hall, that you're not. I've also seen bands where they're used to playing on a small stage. Now they get on this 60, 70 foot wide stage and they all huddle together. There's a they feel sort of insecure, as opposed to spread out, run around a little bit, move around, use the whole stage.
Now, I'm presuming with in-ear monitors, you could make yourself at home on the stage and still hear everybody as well, better than you might have been able to in the past. Because now you don't need a metric ton of wedges all over the place and side fills and a ridiculous stage volume to do it, if you really have it in the ears.
Exactly. And I think, I remember us playing in Clarksburg, West Virginia with Blue Oyster Cult, and the sound man came up to me and went, "Your bass player is louder than my entire sound system." I told my bass player that, and he went, "Cool." So
it didn't sound like that came with any instructions, did it?
Yeah, there you go. You know, so yeah, you're right. I mean, with the technology today, you can, you know, it used to be you had to live with the monitor mix. Now, you know, the bass player can hear one mix, the drummer and the guitar player can get another mix. You've got, like you say, in-ear mixes. So you'd be able to really
walk. But is there a trick in a bigger stage to staying connected with your bandmates, to stay tight, and to stay connected with the audience, because then you don't have the proximity. I mean, there's some bands, many bands, that practice facing each other as you're learning the songs and learning the parts,
right,
and see what's going on. How different is it when you're suddenly, you know, the stage I work at the most, it's got a 72-foot proscenium, and my soundboard is 150 feet away from the edge of the stage. That's just to get to the board. That's not the farthest seats away either.
Right. Yes, it's a huge difference. And I think you find, if you talk to most musicians who came up in the clubs, who suddenly had a record and suddenly were on that 70-foot stage, at first it completely freaks you out. You feel totally separate. You feel like I'm in my world and then the drummer's in his world. But it's like anything else. Once you get used to playing on a large stage, you learn how to, you get that monitor mix, you go over, you lean over towards the drummer or the bass player, so you're connecting, and you just get used to playing. The great guys are the guys who can go in the big hall and still play like they were playing in a club. They you know, you get that tight thing, but it's like anything else. You have to learn how to do it on the bigger stage, you know. Talk to some ball player who played in some, you know, little ballpark, and all of a sudden, you know, he's playing at Yankee Stadium, and he's got to figure out, wow, this is it's, you know, if you ever saw Hoosiers, did you ever see the movie Hoosiers?
Yeah, it's still the same game.
Remember the scene where he has him measure it up? How high is that basket? It's 10 feet. Doesn't matter if you're in a high school gym, that the court is the same, and it's really the same musically. You're still playing rock and roll, or whatever you're playing, and once you keep that in your mind, the background, just like a professional basketball player, he doesn't care if people are waving those big foam rubber fingers while he's shooting his foul shot. He's too focused. And for music, you really have to be focused. You have to be focused on what you're playing. And if you can stay focused, you won't let that other stuff. Once you get accustomed to it, acclimated to it, you'll be able to make it work.
Sometimes I hear this come up as a, I'll call it a common debate point. Do tend to feel like you're playing for yourself when you're playing up there, or do you tend to feel like you're playing to the audience? I mean, is there some bridge between them, or especially in those bigger shows when there might be more disconnect between yourself and the individuals? Do you have to switch to a mode where you go, all right, I'm going to play this for me?
Well, it goes back and forth. I try to play for the people. I think, like, I notice when I'm playing, you know, if I'm playing a solo or something, and I'll look, you know, sometimes my eyes are closed, but sometimes I'll look out. If I look in somebody's face and I get the feeling like, wow, this person sounds like they're listening to me, that just kicks me into gear. It's like, wow, this, I'm playing and I can tell from the look on this person's face, they're focusing in on what I'm doing, which is what it's about. It's a sharing process. It's not...
It's a communication.
It's communication all the way. And when people communicate, hey, look, what's applause? You know, applause gets you off. People are clapping and they're saying that they like what you're doing. And then you get confident. And as soon as you get confidence up, you're sailing, you know, because you're confident. Hey, I mean, I've played in clubs where... You know, it's sort of like the Blues Brothers, where they show up at the Hillbilly Club, and they're playing behind the chicken wire.
You're the good old boys.
And right, the good old boys, exactly. Well, I've been in the clubs where I thought we were going to get the crap kicked out of us. It's like we're playing rock music. We're in a total wrong venue. But the one thing good about music is, if the band gets into it themselves, and I've told the Muzzle Loaders, we've talked about this. As long as you're enjoying it within the five or six or four of you, people will pick up on that. Even if you're playing a kind of music they're not quite used to, they're watching the band. They're saying, hey, you know what? This band, they're into what they're doing. They're looking at each other. There's eye contact. They're enjoying what they're playing. Next thing you know, if you're playing something good, they're going to get into it. Sometimes you got to win them over, you know, especially when you're playing music that they haven't heard before. Like the Muzzle Loaders, we do songs that are originals. They're easily picked up because they're real basic kind of songs, but they're still not songs people hear on the radio, so they're checking you out, and you've got to just be confident and enjoy what you're doing, and if they see you're enjoying it, they'll usually get into it.
And I hope the people listening to this will get into the Muzzle Loaders, if not the James Gang. I think it's time for us to put a bow on this.
Thanks so much, and ta-ta, everyone.
Thank you very much. It's Richard Shack from the James Gang and the Muzzle Loaders, more recently on Womb Radio.